Thank you, Steve. I'd like to briefly run through a sequence of merger galaxies and tell you what we have learned over the last 10 years or so about globular cluster formation from them. First, a few words to remind us all what makes us call a cluster a young globular cluster. Then I'd like to go to the formation and early evolution, let's say the first 10 to the 8 years of clusters. Then say a few words about reaching adulthood, by which I mean what happens in the next kind of billion years to these global cluster systems that have been freshly formed. And I'll say a few words about systemic evolution, how we can trace the evolution from there to the old systems like elliptical galaxies with bimodal cluster distributions. To the extent that some of the work I'm describing is my own, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators, Brad Whitmore, Mike Fall, Brian Miller, Arunav Kundu, and in spectroscopy, Pat Seitzer, Gene Brody, and Jay Strader. As I said, it is very helpful to kind of study the various effects as a function of age along a merger sequence. You see here to the left the classical Toomey sequence of increasingly merged colliding pairs of spirals. What is important to realize is the huge advantage we have in the nearby galaxies when we study the young systems. A merger timescale is typically 300 million years, so you have kind of three mergers per giga year. Well, here we have fully two decades from 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 9 years to study the detailed processes. When we're interested in intermediate age systems, let's say from 1 to 7 giga years, already the time span is crunched to 0.8 decs, and of course fully the first half of the history of global cluster formation and of the universe is crunched in 0.3 decs. So it is very much harder to see details here than here. When we see pictures like the well-known picture of the antennae galaxies taken with the Hubble Space Telescope, we see that there are 10,000s, 100,000s of stars formed. There are also thousands of clusters formed. Yet we know that only one or two merger timescales later, they're typically more like 100 to 500, perhaps 1,000 globular clusters left. So the question is, when we see all these multitude of clusters here, how do we know which will be globular clusters and which not? So let's deal a little bit with the nature of the clusters. Immediately after the launch of the Hubble, it was a bit controversial as to just exactly what the size were of these dots that one saw there in distant galaxies. But the subject was laid to rest, I guess, by the classic paper by Meurer et al., in which they plotted the half-light radii logarithmically of clusters in about 10 or 12 starbursts in merger galaxies and showed that the distribution of the half-light radii was very similar to that of the half-light radii of global clusters in the Milky Way, which have kind of a median half-light radius of about 3 parsec. And all investigations since then have shown that most of these clusters that one sees with the Hubble in neighboring galaxies are actually of the right size to be global clusters. But being the right size in a very young cluster doesn't guarantee you yet that you will survive as a globular cluster. And there many people think that what's necessary is to know something about the mass. The truth is that what you really have to know is something about the age. If a cluster is only, let's say, 10 million years old, which is kind of 2-3 internal crossing times, nobody, I believe, right now can say if that cluster will remain bound as a globular cluster. On the other hand, when you're lucky enough to look at a supercluster of some sorts like W3 in the merger remnant 7252, you have a beautiful Balmer absorption line spectrum. The red line is superposed, is a model from the new Brizuel-Charlot 2003 models. It fits exceedingly well. You know the age of this cluster is roughly 500 million years. That is of the order of 100 internal crossing times. If the cluster is still the right size of a globular cluster, then that puts a tremendously sharp limit on any possible expansion velocity, and the cluster is very likely to still be around for a long time. And in this case, it is less than 7 parsec half-light radius. Nevertheless, it is very interesting to know something about the masses of young clusters, especially to decide whether they are perhaps have normal or abnormal initial mass functions of their stars. There are two methods that people are using to estimate masses. One is the photometric method, in which you essentially take a model with a certain initial mass function of a star cluster, and you compare the observed cluster's luminosity given its age with the models, and immediately tells you an estimate, assuming that the model is correct, an estimate for the masses. And typically one finds masses of 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 7 solar masses for these clusters. An extreme case is cluster W3 that I just showed you a spectrum of a minute ago. When we first did the estimate with Seitzer, we found 1.8 times 10 to the 8 solar masses. Now that's truly gigantic. That's nearly 100 times omega sen. It turns out that Marrowstone pointed out, if you properly include the AGB phase in these clusters that are a few hundred million years old, then actually it reduces the mass to a still very hefty 70 million solar masses. And of course, we are going to try to measure the mass directly because that's what you need. More reliable are the dynamical masses, which are actually measured. You measure the velocity dispersion, you measure a characteristic size, you apply the virial theorem. And here, for the few systems where that has been done with high-resolution spectroscopy, it's hard work, in general, the masses are confirmed to be in the range 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 6.7 so far have been found solar masses. So it seems that in many of the clusters, the masses are what you would expect for a young globular cluster. Now let's move on and see what we can learn about the formation of these clusters. One of the first things that struck us when we took Hubble images was that actually the clusters themselves, the young clusters, are clustered. And that is probably because they form in high density regions, so wherever you have a lot of molecular gas, like in the overlap region of the antennae here, it just doesn't form just one cluster, but several clusters, typically half a dozen to a dozen clusters. Here you see several such knots. From the ground, they had been regarded as one knot, but in detail, there's a lot of structure and substructure. This is knot S, called so by Rubin and Ford in 1970. And in here are not only many knots, but actually a slightly older cluster called number 430. And I'll show you their structural profiles. Here is the lightness, the surface brightness, plotted as a function of logarithmic radius. What is striking is that the two very young clusters, knot S with 7 million years, number 430 with 11 million years, have these power law envelopes. That is very typical of freshborn clusters. If, for comparison, you do the photometry on another cluster, also in the antennae, but that's 500 million years old, formed earlier in the beginning of the collision, you see that its core radius is already significantly larger than those of the young clusters, and it now has a tidal radius, which tells you that over a shorter period as 500 million years, there's significant erosion in the envelopes. Excuse me? Yes, that's the resolution of the PC. Yes. Yes, and you can deconvolve, you can play all kinds of games. So the one issue that has come up is, well, how many young clusters are we missing? I mean, they are associated with molecular gas, there's extinction, and claims were made a few years ago that perhaps most young clusters are missed. There's a very nice paper by Whitmore and Zhang, 2002, laying that actually to rest. They did a clever thing. They looked at the overlap region of the antennae and tried to identify optically all the clusters that are seen by their thermal radio emission. It turns out they fully can identify fully 85% of them. So the number of hidden clusters cannot be much more than of the order of 10 to 20%. What is also interesting is that the heavy extinction, they found extinctions for these clusters of half a magnitude to 7.5 magnitudes, that the extinction seems to rapidly diminish as the clusters age. By the time clusters are 6 million years old, the extinction is typically 1 magnitude or less, which must mean that the clusters are blowing away the molecular gas and dust. An extreme case is the most heavily extinguished cluster, WS80. It is 2 million years old. It has 7.5 magnitudes of extinction. It is in radio the most luminous object. And if you correct the optical flux for the extinction, you actually find that it is also the most luminous cluster in the antennae with an absolute visual magnitude of about -15.5. Of course, the single most important thing, as we already heard several times this morning, was the discovery that young cluster systems have a the power law luminosity functions, which, as has been shown, translate essentially into power law mass functions. This has since then been found for dozens of systems, so it's a very universal property. And it is this property, as we've heard, that suggested that giant molecular clouds are the progenitors of globular clusters. The laws of the mass distribution of the cloud has in the local group have an index of -1.6. In the merger galaxies, we find between 1.6 and 2 or 2.1. So there's this agreement. There's also a striking agreement about the mass ranges themselves, namely the most massive globular cluster in the local group, or at least in the Milky Way, is 5 times 10 to the 6 solar masses. The most massive giant molecular clouds are only a little bit more. So it seems that if formation of stars in these clouds is very efficient, they could well be that giant molecular clouds turn into globular clusters. One detail that is often little appreciated and that I think argues against some supergiant molecular clouds is the fact that in young merger remnants, kind of half a giga-year old remnants, the clusters, the numbers of clusters as a function of radius, shown here by the data points for the galaxy NGC 3921, very closely track the light. And since we know that in mergers, there is violent relaxation that completely redistributes the stars from two disks into an elliptical light distribution, it tells us that whatever forms the clusters behaves like point masses. People have this notion that during a merger, and it is correct, gas gets funneled towards the center. If really that happened first, and then clusters formed out of some supergiant molecular clouds deep in there, they would not have the same distribution as the background light. It harks back to what I think Ivan King asked in the previous session. So I think this tells us that the precursors of the clusters behave like point masses, and to me, that seems to indicate that they are likely compact objects like giant molecular clouds. And this, of course, fits in nicely with the idea first proposed, I believe, by Jorg and Solomon in 92, that globular clusters form from such clouds that get suddenly squeezed in a high-pressure environment of a starburst. After their formation, the clusters, of course, have hundreds, if not thousands, of O stars. They expel gas from the individual star winds. And this is seen in, for instance, the images obtained by Chandra of the antennae galaxies, where roughly half the total X-ray flux in 1 to 10 keV is actually from the interstellar medium. What is interesting is that there are both places where the X-ray gas correlates with H-alpha, and there are places where it anti-correlates. The places where the gas anti-correlates seem to be always places where there are big young star clusters like NOT-S. When you look at NOT-S, you find that the H-alpha forms a ring of about 1.5 kiloparsec radius around the cluster region, and the ring cavity is filled with hot X-ray gas. And Fabiano et al. point out that the luminosity of these, what they call super bubbles in the antennae, are humongous. They are 10 to 100 times the X-ray luminosity of 30 Doradus. They're also much larger than the super bubble luminosities in M101, and they estimated gas masses of 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 solar masses. There are now theoretical papers beginning to appear explaining how these models are, that the central temperatures are predicted to be 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 degrees, and mass loss rates for typical superclusters perhaps as much as 10 to the 4 solar masses per year. If anybody doubts that these winds are blowing from the young clusters, here is direct evidence. Those are UV spectra taken of NOT S and K by our team in 1998. Klaus Leiter here plotted them. The thin lines are model spectra that he has computed, these Starburst 99 models, for 1 million years, 3 million years, 5, 7, and 10. And the thick lines are the spectrum of NOT K, which is 3 million years old, and of NOT S, which is 7 million years old. And you can see these very characteristic P Cygni profiles here in the silicon 4 and carbon 4 lines, which are well-known signatures of stellar winds. Here, cluster winds. If we go on in time, in the next billion year, what can we learn from what we observe in merger remnants? In other words, when the merger completes within 300 million years, what happens to the clusters in these galaxies? About four or five such merger remnants have been studied. I'm showing you here two that our team has worked on. One is this NGC 3921, a galaxy late in the Tumri sequence. The body is already very much an elliptical, essentially. You can call it a present-day proto-elliptical. It still has two tails, showing you that essentially there were two disk galaxies that merged. And we found about 100 clusters, candidate clusters, and 50 associations, by which I mean loser little things that are not as symmetric as the very sharp point sources. This system, by the way, is nearly at coma cluster distance. When you look at just the PC image of this galaxy, you find the surprising fact that half of all the globular cluster candidates we can distinguish are in the central region of 5 kiloparsec radius, which shows you how tremendously much the material does get concentrated during mergers and builds up this classical relaxed R to the 1 quarter profile. However, there are only three associations, and it's not quite clear to me how much that reflects that they're harder to find in this messy background, but I believe that it really is a dearth, and that to some extent the associations, being fluffy, delicate objects, get broken up by the churning of the gravitational field. I will now show you the spectra of these two brightest clusters that Brody, Seitzer, and I took 2 years ago with the Keck telescope. Here are in black the spectra of cluster S1, which is about 450 million years old, S2, which is about 280 million years old, and superposed in color are the best fitting, or nearly the best fitting, model spectra from the new Brusoil-Charlot library. And again, you see the fits are very good. You see the Balmer absorption line. You see that the K line is kind of stronger in this slightly older cluster than it is in the younger cluster. There's no question that these spectra are very well reproduced by normal cluster model spectra with normal initial mass functions. I'll make this point once more, because after observations in 1275, a few years ago, there was the notion that perhaps these clusters might be very deficient in lower main sequence stars. And that was because the Balmer absorption lines in those clusters were found to be stronger than any model could easily reproduce. This is not the case in the two merger remnants that we have studied, neither in NGC 3921 nor in 7252. Shown here are models from Brusoil-Charlot, still 1996, of the H-beta line strength as a function of logarithmic age. Down here, perhaps more reliable observationally, the average of H-beta, H-gamma, H-delta as a function of logarithmic age. And the solid curve is for cluster models with empirical observed stellar atmospheres, not with computed atmospheres. And you see that the average of these lines for clusters S1 and S2 falls right on top of the curves. The models by Brusoil-Charlot were computed with Saltpeter IMFs. Therefore, there is no reason really to doubt that these clusters have normal IMFs. It would be nice, of course, to confirm this with velocity dispersion measurements. Excuse me, what lower limit? 0.1 solar masses, 0.1 to 100. This is the other merger remnant I've worked all my life on, NGC 7252, when we take a picture with the WIFPIC 2 camera, as we did about 5-6 years ago. We found 500 candidate clusters. That's a paper by Miller et al. What is interesting is that there are three populations of clusters in this galaxy. There's a population of extremely young clusters in a disk that's called the mini spiral. That's a disk of molecular gas and ionized gas at the center. They're buried in emission lines. Nobody has studied yet them. There are about 300 clusters sprinkled throughout the halo of NGC 7252 that from their colors all appear to be young, about 400 to 600 million years old. And then there is a sprinkling, even smaller sprinkling, of the much fainter old metal poor classical clusters, as I'll show you in a minute. What is important was important that we managed to do spectroscopy of 8 of these clusters with Seitzer a few years ago. We now have 45, but they're still to be analyzed. And what we found was that for the two with the best signal to noise, we could measure the metallicity, and both of these clusters are rather close to solar metallicity. And as Paul Hootfroy would tell us more on Thursday, this is now being found in increasing numbers of merger remnants, that the second generation clusters are roughly solar metallicity. What is important is now to realize that, of course, these clusters all form a halo population of 300 objects in a recently formed proto-elliptical of solar metallicity and 400 to 600 million years old. Of the eight spectra we took, one was very different from the others. That was a much, much younger cluster, which I'd like to point out. It's called S101. I had found it from the ground, and it is still embedded in its H2 region. We could measure the metallicity of its gas of the H2 region, and it is also solar metallicity. What I find cute is that this is a cluster, the most distant cluster of them all. It sits out here at 15 kiloparsec projected distance from the center, in a filament of gas that is tied to the eastern tail. It wraps around here, and it is known from the neutral hydrogen measurements that it is falling in with at least 240 kilometers per second. So it is interesting that in a filament of the outskirts of some disk of an SC galaxy, 500 million years ago was ejected as a tidal tail. It's coming, falling back down, and some giant molecular cloud in there is being squeezed up on arrival in the galaxy. We don't understand the details, but it is remarkable that it is very close to the point where all H1 disappears. Somehow something heats the H1 up, and the partially as that, clusters can form with considerable delay. The main upshot from all these observations of young merger remnants is that they form, before our very eyes, a second generation of clusters. Here you see, for the case of NGC 7252, the bimodal color distribution. However, note that the old metal poor clusters are the redder ones here, and the young solar metallicity clusters are still bluer than the old metal poor ones. The question then immediately is, can we see an evolution from there to the elliptical galaxies where the opposite is true? A simulation was made a few years ago by Brian Miller and published in Whitmore et al. 1997, in which he tried to see how would systems look like in four different galaxies, which each had an old metal poor population shown by the open little circles, and where the one galaxy would have a half giga year old solar metallicity second generation population, this one 1 giga year, 3 giga years, and 10 giga years old. And the simulations based on Brugeois-Charlot models show you that, of course, first the metal rich clusters are very much brighter and bluer than the metal poor ones. At 1 giga year, they're still brighter, but they start catching up in color with the metal poor ones. At 3 giga years, they're still a bit brighter than the metal poor ones, but they're already turning redder because there are metals in their atmospheres much more. And at 10 giga years, they're significantly redder and a little bit fainter. And the question is, can we see this? In a big sense, yes. I'm showing here the color distributions of the antennae of the merger remnant 3921 that I showed you, of 7252, and for comparison, here's M87. So you certainly see that there's a trend as the remnants age for the clusters to become redder, and then they appear here on this side. But what we would like to see is a whole transition here, and there are about four or five galaxies so far only known, and they don't quite fill the gap. Rather than showing you a second such diagram, I'll show you a diagram that summarizes this evidence. Namely, I'm plotting the difference between the peak of the second generation and of the first generation clusters in color, delta V minus I, negative meaning the second generation is bluer, positive it is redder than the first generation, versus the magnitude difference of the two populations. So it's a completely differential diagram. Plotted by a red line is the prediction from Brugeois-Charlot model, again with observed Gunn-Striker library of spectra, how this difference should evolve as a function of time. Here's 1 giga year, here is 15 giga years, and here is 10 million years. And you see that indeed the antennae systems are here, much bluer the second generation, the first generation. Here are the two young merger remnants, half a giga year old. Here is M87. And here in between are elliptical galaxies with intermediate age clusters, NGC 1700, 3610, and Fornax-A, NGC 1316, about which Paul will tell us much more on Thursday. So it does look as if there's continuity in the evolution of globular cluster systems. What about the luminosity functions? I've already mentioned that essentially the luminosity functions of all young cluster systems with your favorite merger. You can pick 4038, 3921, Steve Zepp's NGC 3256. They all have power laws. Can we see the erosion that is predicted and that has been recently been calculated in some detail by Fall and Zhang? Can we see the erosion at the low mass end? The answer there is not yet quite. What has been found so far is the first two cases where you can see very significant differences between the luminosity functions of the old and the intermediate age clusters. One of them is NGC 3610, which has a beautiful bimodal color distribution of its cluster systems. And if you say, ask, what is the luminosity function of the clusters blueward of 1.02 in V minus I and of those redward, you find these two functions. You find that the blue ones here, the solid part of the histogram, are essentially look like a Gaussian distribution. Those are the metal poor clusters. And the more metal-rich clusters have a luminosity function that extends further to brighter magnitudes than the blue ones and has many more objects near the incompleteness limit, which is the vertical dashed line. So it looks as if the old clusters are Gaussian, the intermediate age clusters are still nearly a power law, and the only thing that is disturbing is that we don't quite understand yet why we don't see the turnover that one should begin to see at 3-4 giga year according to the Fall and Zhang models. But there's very small numbers involved, and current observations are planned and I think soon to be executed with ACS with Paul Goodfroy to find whether we actually cannot observe the turnover. For the moment, it's not observed. The other galaxy that he will talk about is NGC 1316. Quickly, one word about radial evolution. I've already pointed out that in young merger remnants, the clusters number density as a function of radius very closely tracks the light, which is the line. The same is true in 7252. It looks as if in an intermediate age remnant like NGC 1316, which may be roughly 3 giga year old, you start seeing a central depression of the cluster systems relative to the light. And certainly in ellipticals, it has long been known that many have global cluster populations with larger core radii, where core radius of the system, not of an individual cluster, than the underlying light distribution. I picked one from the literature. So it does seem as if the center is an environment in which cluster destruction is more efficient than in the outskirts. Of course, everywhere there are internal mechanisms that lead to the destruction of clusters. Well, I think there are two points that emerge from all this work. The first one is that it looks very much as if second generation globular clusters form with their host galaxies. In other words, the same mergers that form the cluster systems are the mergers that form the elliptical galaxy. I'm reminding you that there are very nice models like those by Barnes that show you that when you merge two spiral galaxies, the stars tend to end up in a heap of, that's a triaxial ellipsoid of some form. The hot gas, the initially warm gas, like the H2 gas, ends up heated to 1,000,000 degrees as a kind of hot corona, X-ray corona, and the cool gas gets driven towards the center. For any people who will propose to you other formation scenarios for second generation clusters, you should ask them if they have the corresponding models to show that they know how the ellipticals formed. I believe that virtually all ellipticals involved a major merger. I'm not saying it was a single one, we know it's hierarchical, but that an equal mass merger is a precondition to end up with a triaxial body. The second lesson, I think, and we have heard, and there are people much more competent than me to explain that, but is really, if you analyze what is the bottom line of it all, is that it seems the mergers are telling us that you can have a population of giant molecular clouds if only you find a means, like in a merger, to rapidly increase the external pressure on these clusters, you can convert them to global clusters. And admittedly, there are other scenarios, there are other ideas. But what I like about it is that it then leads to somehow a very simple global cluster formation scenario with a unifying theme of the pressure increase. According to this and Chen's idea, and we already have heard this morning a bit about this and other ideas, essentially the pressure increase for the old metal poor clusters would be that created by the cosmological reionization. whereas the pressure increase in later metal-rich cluster systems will be provided by major mergers, perhaps multiple mergers, and certainly also in some cases by minor mergers. It is quite impressive that in the S0 galaxy, NGC 3115, the red metal-rich clusters seem to be more associated with the disk than with the bulge, showing that some minor merger may have hit a galaxy with its molecular, giant molecular clouds and turned them into globular clusters. So my conclusions then in summary are that it appears that gas-rich mergers are forming both the second generation clusters and the elliptical and perhaps even S0 galaxies. It is quite clear now that in many ongoing disk mergers, we can observe the formation of globular clusters. What is difficult is there is to predict which clusters will survive as globulars, which not, because they're so young. But typically, after it's all over, there seem to be 100 to 1,000 globular clusters left, and they were formed during the merger. I've shown you the extraordinary case of NGC 7252, where you actually have a halo population of 300 clusters, and I didn't mention it has a velocity dispersion of 140 kilometers per second, so there's no question it's a halo population of half giga-year-old solar metallicity clusters. Just imagine if you took Omega Sen and the Milky Way and replaced it by this W3, it would glow at minus third magnitude in the sky because it's 250 times brighter than Omega Sen. And then I've pointed out that there are links, about which we'll hear much more on Thursday, from these young cluster systems to the old ones. We think we're beginning to see differences in the mass functions of the globular cluster systems, the younger ones being more power law-like, but we have not yet managed to see directly the turnover that is predicted by models of erosion at the low mass end. And finally, I think the bottom line is it is pretty clear that giant molecular clouds must be involved in the formation of these clusters, and one attractive scenario is the pressure increase of 100 to 1,000 times that is kind of triggering the collapse, and I'm sure Bruce will tell us much more about it. Thank you.
Any evidence yet for any of these clusters being supersolar, factors of two, say like what you see in ellipticals?
Yes, there's a German group that has about four or five such systems, and they seem to, the metallicity seems to very closely track the metallicity of the elliptical itself. So the answer is, I think, the highest may be three times solar or so, but they have been observed. The problem with the ellipticals in general, which we have also run into, is it is very hard to do spectroscopy on the innermost clusters where the metallicity is highest because they're just drowning in background.
Stars and ellipticals and the stars and the globular, that once you get above solar, the models aren't very interpretable in terms of directly metallicity. But there are, as much as the evidence is for these objects and ellipticals, it's equally good, even stronger, for the globulars, because it's easier to interpret a single, simple stellar population.
So I hate to ask a question that's almost semantics, but I was struck by this at the beginning of your talk. If you have a very young star cluster that has about the right mass and about the right size to be called a global cluster, you seem to want it to survive long enough before you can really call it a global cluster. So how long does a young star cluster have to survive before you're willing to call it a global cluster?
Well, if, as you know, traditionally the difference is between global cluster, open cluster for poor clusters, and many experts agree that there's really a continuum there, and then association. I mean, an object that is clearly expanding, take a global cluster in the antennae, or a cluster in the antennae that's 5 to 10 million years old. If it has 1 kilometer per second expansion velocity, it's going to be 100 parsec in diameter in 100 million years. And that's clearly not what anyone would call a globular cluster. So my answer is I want to wait 5 to 10 internal crossing times. If it still is compact enough to be look like a globular cluster out there, start calling it a protoglobular cluster or a globular cluster.
Are the line widths resolved or not?
Oh, the Balmer lines are always resolved because they're so wide. With the metal lines, it's a bit harder. In that case, we had about 5 to 6 angstrom resolution. The best spectra we have are still those from Tololo many years ago, those had about 4 angstrom resolution. Of course, the Balmer lines, which are very well resolved.
So are you at, can you measure internal velocity dispersions then?
Yes, but the Balmer lines are not very good for that, so you really want to resolve the metal lines. So what has happened is, and I'm sorry if I didn't credit the papers, the first time that was done was in 1996 by Ho and Filipenko on the clusters in NGC 1569 and 1705, I guess. And those are measured with a shell resolution, kind of resolutions of the order of 40,000. And then you can measure the velocity dispersion, and they have a number like 14 plus minus a kilometers per second or so. On these slightly older clusters, 500 million years, we have measurement with we have observations with UVS, but I have not yet heard from my German collaborators what the measurement is. That is one we very badly want to measure because of this unbelievably large mass, if it really is true.
The other question is, what's the implications for the specific frequency with this whole scenario? I mean, can we understand the stuff that Harris does within this picture?
We can understand some, but not all. I think if you look at NGC 7252, the best studied system, if you take as a baseline the old metal poor clusters, the new clusters are about 80% as much. So it has nearly but not quite doubled the number of globular clusters. So let it fade for 10 giga years and it will have the specific frequency of a field elliptical, not a cluster elliptical, which is kind of mildly enhanced. In NGC 3921, we only have a lower limit. It is roughly 40% increase, but it could be much more because we essentially cannot reliably measure the number of old clusters. So it looks as if field ellipticals can be explained this way. It goes in certainly in the right direction, maybe even quantitative enough, but we certainly cannot explain systems like M87 or so where you have tenfold increase. That must be that I suspect that most mergers that led to M87 were in such an early epoch where most galaxies were mostly gas, that basically that's what drives up the numbers, but I'm not an expert on this.
Even the numbers for most of the massive ones are actually going down. M87 is about the only one that's that high.
But still
1399
high.
1399 has gone down by a factor of 2 or 3 in the last Dersch et al. Paper, so it's not clear that it is an order of magnitude higher than the field ellipticals as claimed.
I'd just like to make a remark about this question of specific frequency. I think it's a very interesting question and it motivated some of the work in this field, but it's very difficult to do things quantitatively precisely when you're dealing with these young globular cluster systems. And the problem there is that the luminosity function of the clusters is rising like L to the minus 2. So the number of clusters you count depends very sensitively on the magnitude to which you count them. And so that makes it very, very difficult to talk about the number of clusters that would be made and whether they account, you know, whether you, when you do the bookkeeping for the merger of two spiral galaxies with these power law luminosity functions, when you put them together, whether you'd have the correct number of globular clusters to be in the resulting elliptical galaxy. If the luminosity function had a turnover, and so that you, when you count it down to fainter magnitudes, you count it to a definite number, the problem would be easier. The problem is just this power law luminosity function makes it very difficult.
Mass and luminosity limit of the ones you think will survive to the same turnover in the old ones.
The problem is the dynamical evolution here. The dynamical evolution that you and Enrico will talk about introduces at least a factor of 2 variation.
I'm a bit surprised about your decimation of star clusters in the early star clusters. I mean, you really claim, thank you, that you need a lot of global clusters to be, or young populous clusters to be destroyed in the early evolution, and then later you remain a few and they are visible later as globular clusters. But is it, I always thought that it was something like a continuous destruction of star clusters and not a flaring up of a lot of star clusters and then you decimate them, you kill 90% of them and you return, you continue.
Oh, I didn't mean to imply that. It's exactly what you say. It's a continuous formation of star clusters and only the most solid, most dense nuggets eventually survive in the long run.
There is a very clear difference, we think, between star clusters that does survive and if you look at a very young cluster.
that does survive, or a star cluster that would not survive simply by, well, if you say they're unbound by birth, basically. I mean, wouldn't there be other observations?
But how do you measure that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an observer, but my guess around it. So, I mean, one of the reasons that the star cluster is destroyed is because the star formation efficiency was, for example, very low. So there must be a lot of gas around the star clusters which are unbound at birth, for example.
That may all be right. I'm simply pointing out that if one of these young clusters has a velocity dispersion, as the ones measured by Ho and Filipenko in a 4 or 5 million-year-old cluster, of 15 kilometers per second, all I'm saying is you don't know that it will remain a globular cluster, even if you say, hi, the mass is right, our mass is 10 to the 6 solar masses, because one kilometer in those 15, 1 kilometer of systematic expansion will destroy the cluster in much less than 100 million years.
Well, that's part of the theory argument. If the cluster is more massive, then it's 1 kilometer per second of the matter.
I'm an observer. For me, it's the observational fact that in the antennae, we saw of the order of 2,000 clusters. It depends how you count. We can count 4,000, but we're not sure if they were, you know, just little star groupings or not. But we saw 2,000 clusters, yet in these remnants of actually at least as massive mergers as the antennae currently are undergoing, like 3921 and 7252, we don't see really more than 500 clusters, actually less. So I'm just inferring that a fair number of those clusters simply won't make it.
To build on what Francois said and abuse my privilege as chairman, we tried to do this in NGC 3256. If you try to calculate the efficiency with which the youngest ones you're seeing are forming, it's quite high. Gerhard Moir, it goes back to Moir et al., where as much to 20%, even maybe more, of the star formation that's going on now is in these dense knots. But there's no old system that has anything close to that left in compact remnants. And so if you try to trace the fraction of the stars formed in any given population that have remained in compact star clusters, it doesn't, there seems to be some early loss that isn't just as slow as sort of, you know, two-body relaxation and tidal fields.
Well, it must be faster to relaxation.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
It would be faster, but then you would also see, for example, the stray stars. If you did so, you would see the fact that they're going to be very low.
Sure, but there are plenty.
So you have all O-stars which are
Well, remember in 3921, kind of the youngest completed merger remnant that we looked at, there were 50 associations and 100 much sharper globular clusters. And I actually was a big struggle within our team. I wanted to say there are 50 associations, and they said, oh, don't confuse the picture. But I think those are the last of the dissolving clusters. But there may be many more.
There are lots of young stars that aren't clusters.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, not nearly.
So I guess I'm just going to restate the same question again for the third time. What we want to know as theorists is if there are really two classes,
yeah.
a class of systems that form in a different way and really should not be called global clusters because their initial conditions are such that they could never make it as global clusters, and a different class that normally makes it as a global cluster, and perhaps there are still some that will be disrupted later on because of mass loss or tidal disruption or something like that. But they're in principle, they could make it as a global cluster. Now, when you answered the previous question, you said, no, it's more like
a continuum.
If it's a continuum, then basically you just draw the line somewhere and it's completely arbitrary.
Yes.
What you call a global cluster and what you call something else. So which is it? Is it really a continuum?
I think it's
really
a continuum. I don't know if Bruce will address this, but I think it's a continuum. It's interesting that people in the open cluster community in the Milky Way now think that essentially there is an overlap between the most star-poor decaying globular clusters and the richest open clusters. They really think of it, I think, increasingly as a continuum. Is that right, Ivan? Do you agree?
Not so much.
Not so much. Okay.
They
unbind as they age.
Well, all the same.
Oh, the supernovae start going off within a few million years, expelling the gas. It must have lots to do with the details of how much gas they manage to expel from the cluster, how much the gravitational self-gravity is weakened.
Okay, so
is that right?
So up.
Well, the open clusters have a very small z distribution, they have a smaller velocity dispersion, et cetera, et cetera. So I think if you include kinematics, you can start distinguishing.
So that was my follow-up question. Observationally, can you tell? Can you go back and look at more specifically the kinematics or the mass loss? Perhaps there are indications as to what is the process that actually determines the survival fraction for those very young clusters. Is it really initial conditions, maybe kinematics? Is it the position in the tidal field of the galaxy or the tidal field of the merger? Does it have something to do with rapid mass loss due to stellar evolution in these first few million years? Can you tell observationally?
It's going to be, I'm sure it's going to be done eventually, but I right now don't know that we can easily answer that in that detail. I mean, don't forget that the answers, it's the usual story. Harvey talks of the Milky Way galaxy, which, you know, the last merger may be as long as 10 giga-years ago. I'm talking of young, ongoing mergers, and those are, in the nearest case, like the Antennae, are 1.5 times the Virgo cluster distance, and you're asking me if I can make these detailed arguments. It must be feasible, but it's going to be hard, and probably quite a few years before we have the answers that you seek.
I don't know if Fred's question is about specifically open clusters versus globular, but in the Milky Way, the open clusters have much lower masses, and as a result, they're much more vulnerable to dynamical destruction, and that is why you have to look so hard to find old open clusters. Most of them have already been destroyed.
This is a really quick one about the IMF. You mentioned that it could be fitted by saltpeter down to 0.1 solar masses. Now, the local IMF is a bit flatter than that below a solar mass, which endows it with a characteristic mass of about a solar mass. Could you rule out that in, I mean, what sort of sensitivity do you have? Are you really saying it's steeper, it goes saltpeter all the way down to 0.1, or don't you have that kind of...
From the integrated light measurements, which is all that we're dealing with,
yeah.
I don't think you can make the point. Okay. And I've just noticed that the Brizual, actually I don't know if people know, but Brizual and Shalo have submitted their long, long, long awaited paper in the last days of December 2002, and I got to see a copy. And there, they actually now use a Chabrier function, which is not quite a power law below one solar mass, and then above they have a slope of minus 1.3. But I do not think that from integrated light you can easily distinguish. The only work you can do is in Magellanic cloud clusters or so, where you can actually do the counting with HST and so on. But it's too hard.
Yeah, it's just that in these high pressure environments, a sort of Jeans mass argument would make you expect to have a characteristic mass maybe an order of magnitude lower. In these clusters, and it would be interesting if there was any evidence that the IMF is keeping on going up at low masses.
Not that I know of right now, that would be trustworthy.
Yeah.